The making of quilts is woven into American history. Once a means of necessity to keep families warm and a way of social networking, now some quilts are not only collector items, but also an art form. Today on Talk of Iowa, we'll talk about this folk art and a special exhibit on American quilting at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. We'll piece together the patterns of the past, a century of American quilting, with the museum's director, Tim Walsh, and curator, Maureen Harding. Later in the hour, you'll hear why most workers don't like their jobs. University of Iowa Professor of Management Sarah Rhines talks about a new survey on job satisfaction. Talk of Iowa begins after the news. The craft and art of American quilts on this Talk of Iowa. I'm Julie Englander sitting in for Greg Shanley. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch opens a new exhibit this Saturday that explores patterns of the past, a century of American quilting. The exhibit displays a selection of quilt patterns that have evolved over nearly 100 years from 1850 to 1940. My guests to talk about the exhibit and quilts and quilting in the Americas are director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, Tim Walsh, and museum curator, Maureen Harding. And listeners, you're invited into the conversation. Perhaps there's a special quilt in your life, one that's perhaps been handed down in your family and the story behind it. What does that say about your history? Or do you make quilts? If so, what are your influences? The craft and folk art of American quilts. 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Well, good morning, Tim Walsh and Maureen Harding. It's good to have you here. This sounds like a wonderful exhibit that's going to open on Saturday, January 23rd, and go until March 1st, I believe, at the Hoover.
March 21st.
Well, that would have been a very short exhibit indeed. Let's first, before we get to this particular exhibit, just give listeners an idea of a brief history of quilts and its place in American culture.
Sure. It's one of those extraordinary art forms, and I have to, truth in listening, I'm not a quilter. I'm married to a quilter. I know quilters, but having lived here in Iowa now for nearly 22 years, I've really come to appreciate quilting, and certainly in the Kelowna area. And over the years, Maureen has borrowed different quilts. We've had different other items in other exhibits. And this was a wonderful opportunity to feature this unique art form that seems to have a particular achievement here in Iowa. And we were blessed because of this particular collector in having the opportunity to borrow these kinds of art forms. What surprised me when Maureen began to do the research is how relatively recent quilting is. Mm-hmm. I always thought that this went back to the Mayflower, that they all showed up with quilts. and quite frankly, it really is the last maybe century and a half. And in some ways, it's the 1840s on. And particularly, I think, from the introduction of the sewing machine by Elias Howe and the marketing of the sewing machine by I.B. Singer, Singer, I've forgotten his first name.
Isaac
Singer, that you have a growth in quilting because back in the colonial era, it was really weaving, woven coverlets rather than
spinning and weaving. So it took a while to catch on.
In the 1840s, that's when the textile industry, especially in the Northeast, started taking off. And then all of a sudden, there were just this multitude, variety of fabrics that people could be, pick up for a fairly reasonable price. And so from that point on, when all these fabrics were available, that's when quilting really started taking off. After the colonial era, the women in the colonial era were way too busy taking care of their families and spinning their own cloth, for that matter. And so they didn't have time to quilt.
And so, go ahead, Tim.
Well, I was just going to say, in addition, Maureen found a number of things that are missed, but there's an image, I think, of the so-called quilting bee with dozens mm-hmm. and dozens of women around one big frame doing quilts, when in fact because most colonial farmsteads were, or most frontier farmsteads were small, it might be just one or two women, but it was a way to socialize and use your time well and in a practical way, and also to kind of recycle, use those bits of fabric that didn't have other use that
or fabrics that the clothing may not have survived, but the pieces of fabrics, there were still some good ones in there. They cut them up.
And so quilts are pieces of fabric or padded pieces of blocks or patterns that are stitched together. So there are various techniques.
Yes, I believe it. They really started with, you know, the simple pieced fabrics, and then took off from there. Over the years, it's just been hundreds. I think there's probably thousands of different kinds of quilt patterns.
And they've also been used to represent different causes. As I've been reading, in the Civil War, quilts were sold to send to soldiers to gather money for that cause. The patterns in quilting, too.
Patriotic themes were used. I think the most poignant thing...
Well, I think there's, you know, the AIDS quilt that was very, you know...
Gestures
very
of solidarity,
yes.
Or causes, right. Well, let's get to the collection that you have that will be opening on January 23rd. It's from a collector by the name of Nancy Futzenreiter. Mm-hmm. Tell us about her and how she started her collection. Over 100 quilts she's collected.
She has approximately 100, and she keeps in her home. This is about 20 years ago. Her husband was, he's quite a collector himself of other kinds of things, Lincoln documents and that kind of thing. But he introduced her to antiques and antique shows, and it was the textiles that really drew her eye. She did say that somewhere along the line in the last 20 years, she tried quilting herself once. I don't know if it was really bad or she just decided that wasn't for her, but she absolutely has a huge appreciation for quilters and loves, you know, to keep adding to her collection, especially if she can find a unique piece from back in the 1850s or so.
So where did she go to get to collect these quilts?
Antique shows and, you know, antique sales. Sooner or later, anybody who starts collecting starts learning, you know, the people who, you know, perhaps have a shop or the there's a lot of shows, antique shows and particularly quilt shows throughout the Midwest and throughout the entire nation.
And I think what's certainly increased appreciation for quilts is not only the renewal of quilting after the bicentennial in 1976. There were a lot of quilts, and quilting has become more common. But I think shows like the Antiques Roadshow on public television has made people come to appreciate not only the beauty of these quilts, but their monetary value. And I hate to say that money tends to drive interest, but quite frankly, antique shops and other places and folk museums, for example, have come to display quilts. So quilting has become more of an indigenous art form. And so the quilt that Grandma made that you've kept to kind of stored away in a closet, all of a sudden you take out and you realize has great value. But, of course, it's also a challenge how to store quilts because obviously they're oversized. And do you have quilt chests or, you know, how do you properly display a quilt, which can be a challenge. So that
especially with museums, I don't believe they really paid that much attention to what would be called folk art, especially the high-profile art museums, that kind of thing, until about the 1970s, until the bicentennial of the Revolution. Yeah. And then, since then, most people nowadays think of quilts as high art, whether they're machine-stitched or whether they are, you know, very carefully hand-stitched and they are 100 years old.
Yeah, and they're referred to as fabric arts now, too. Mm-hmm. I think that wasn't something that people thought of. I mean, when back people would teach home economics or sewing in high school, and the idea was that it was just a practical activity. I think certainly as far as the frontier goes, the value of the quilt was you could use up something that you didn't have another use for. You could socialize while you were doing quilting, and you ended up with something practical that would warm you for the winter and please the eye. And so all of those elements come together and they converge and they made it appealing. But I don't think anyone on the frontier had the temerity to say that this was art. This was something very practical that served their purposes, and it was passed on. I think the idea was not that you thought of grandma or great-grandma as a great artist, but that she had produced this, and so it didn't quite have the appreciation that it has today. Mm-hmm. So we've come to have the time to appreciate what our ancestors were able to do on those evenings on the prairie.
In this collection, tell us about some of the quilts that are represented and the patterns that are represented.
We have three types of quilts. We have 24 of Nancy's 100 quilts on mm-hmm. display, and she made the choice. I am not a quilter myself either, and so I would have just chosen, oh, that's nice, or that's nice, and that's nice, and pretty soon it had all 100 on display. We have Amish and Mennonite quilts as one group. One group is classic applique, and then a small group of about six quilts that are unique. And unusual. They are not a traditional pattern.
Okay. How so?
One example is the hired man's quilt. And that's unique because of its size. It's very narrow. Wouldn't even fit a twin bed size today. But it was called the hired man size because of the roving laborers who would stay at different farmhouses throughout the season, and they would have these very narrow cuts to sleep on. And so they're only about, I can't even remember now, maybe 30 inches wide. Anyway, that's just one example.
And that's also referred to as a 9-on-9
That's
quilt?
The pattern.
The pattern.
That's
so
the
it's,
pattern.
It's nine
it's
squares.
The size is the hired man size. Uh-huh. Right.
And so, but kind of explain that. Does that mean, for example, there are nine little squares in each block?
Within each block, and then there are nine blocks.
Nine blocks.
As I understand it. Now, we'll probably have a caller who will tell us that's not true.
Well, there are six unusual quilts. I know Nancy probably has more, and there's one that that we were talking about earlier that's made up of advertising bandanas from circuses, from the Humpty Dumpty Circus, I guess, that it first appeared in New York City in 1868. So it's using unusual pieces of fabrics with messages that led to this circus quilt. There's a stained glass window quilt?
Yes, it looks similar. Some people are more familiar with what they call the Victorian crazy quilt pattern because it's just very random. Lots of, round, odd shapes, not, the particular geometric shapes. But it's it does. You start squinting at it, and it does look like a stained glass. I was really intrigued by all of the pattern names and trying to decide, I guess that does look like ocean waves or, tumbling blocks. And that one in particular is a Mennonite quilt, I believe. Bright, or maybe it's Amish. It's bright, bright fuchsia, and it's hard to look at. It's one of those kaleidoscope types of things. It's like pop art, like, whoa!
Well, we're going to take a break and come back and take your questions. This is Talk of Iowa. We're talking about patterns of the past, a century of American quilting that'll be on display at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library. And we'll be back with Tim Walsh and Maureen Harding in just a few minutes, and we'll take your calls. This is Talk of Iowa. We're talking about patterns of the past, a century of American quilting, an exhibit that will go on display January 23rd through March 21st at the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. And Tim Walsh, the director of the museum, and Maureen Harding, who's the curator, are here talking about this exhibit. And we'll take your calls if you have an interest in quilts, if you have done quilting, or if there is a family quilt in your life, the story behind it, what does that say about your history? 1-866-780-9100. And we do have a caller from Fairfield, Anna Lisa. Welcome to the program, Anna. Lisa, what's your question for Tim and Maureen?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a quilt which my fourth great grandmother back made in around 1850 when she was about 15 years old for her hope chest, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And our family feels like we need to donate it at this point because it really needs to be preserved properly. She was from North Carolina, and my family wanted to donate it to a museum near where she grew up. And I was wondering, how do I go about researching a museum that could take care of it and would be interested? And I'm going to hang up now and let you talk.
All right. Thanks for your question.
It's an excellent question, because this comes to us on a regular basis, this type of question, not just about quilts. And we would encourage Annalisa to call us at the library, Tim Walsh or Maureen Harding. And the number is 643-5301, area code 319-643-5301, and ask for Maureen or Tim. And what we'll try to do is to find an appropriate institution. For example, there's a wonderful North Carolina Department of Archives and History, and North Carolina is one of those states that really takes great care and concern about preserving its heritage. For the most part, of course, we're dealing with Iowa artifacts and items, and we try to link them up to the State Historical Society of Iowa or another appropriate institution, sometimes from within the county. But yes, be good stewards of the items that your ancestors have passed on, and often the best solution is to pass them on to an institution.
Just like, well, Nancy Futzenreiter hasn't passed, she's displaying the quilts.
Right.
They're not passed on so much, but they're on display to see the various...
At some point, there will be a challenge for Nancy and for her husband, who's a Lincoln collector, is to where do these items go? Do you, in effect, auction them off and allow others to purchase them, or do you donate them to an institution? And, in some cases, institutions will keep them together as collections. The big challenge for most museums, and certainly with quilts, as Maureen will tell you, and there's a wonderful quilt museum down in Kelowna, and that is trying to display all the quilts that you have, because they take up so much space. And, of course, fabric has to be displayed in a certain way. You can't leave it up permanently. The fabric threads will pull. So there's always a challenge in how you care for them.
We have another caller, Lynn from Cedar Rapids. Lynn, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Hi. I actually have just a brief story about my family quilt. My grandmother started a quilt with the intentions that it would be given to her last grandchild. And we have very large German Catholic families up in Northeast Iowa. And she passed away in the 1950s, the late 1950s, and I was the last grandchild born in 1976. So this quilt was started by her and then completed by all seven of her daughters. And one of the aunts lived in Jerusalem, and it even traveled there to be worked on. So when all was said and done, there ended up being like 60 grandchildren, and I was very fortunate to receive that quilt, and I never knew my grandmother, but it was a piece of her that I have, and I'm very fortunate to receive it.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
They refer to quilts as keepers of dreams, right. And in some ways, when you look at a quilt, it will bring back memories of people in the past or different items or fabrics that meant something to the family early on. It's a wonderful legacy. It's like a page from the family Bible.
It really is.
And it's really good that you have that story, because so many of the quilts have lost, the stories have been lost.
Please write the story down, too. One of the great values of items like this is to have the written story that goes with it, because it gives it greater value.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Lynn.
Thanks,
Lynn. Appreciate it. Thank you. And we'll go next to Clara in Springdale. Welcome to the program, Clara.
Thanks, Julie, and thank you for having this topic. I've been a quilter for 38 years. I'm quilting as I'm listening. I would just like to add a little bit to the brief history that was given.
Good.
Quilting, if you define it as fabric which is stitched, most times with a backing or something in between three pieces, goes back to early Egypt. And in the United States, we had printers of fabric and quilts as early as 1750. In the colonial period, a common technique was called broderie purse, which was cutting out many times florals from printed fabric and then appliquing it on another piece of fabric and then creating a quilt from that. They're not very common out here in Iowa or in the Midwest, although this is big quilting territory. So that the history of quilting in the United States really does have an early an early Provence, not necessarily of patchwork, but of other types of quilting. I'm so pleased and anxious to see this exhibit in West Branch. And I would also encourage people that have quilts to store them properly, get them out of those cedar chests, don't put them around plastic, don't expose them to too much sunlight. great place to store a quilt is just flat on a bed in a guest room, maybe with a sheet over it if it gets too much light. There is also, if one looks at Wikipedia under quilting, you'll get several references to books about the history of quilting. So it's a great topic.
Okay.
There are 27 million Americans who quilt, mostly
wow.
women. So it is alive and well.
Thank you. Clara, thanks for calling in. We appreciate
you're welcome,
all that
Julie.
Information. That's marvelous.
Thank
it's
you.
Good to know to preserve quilts that way, just, to get it out of the cedar chest. Okay.
That's right. I think people think, oh, well, I have to store it all away. And Claire is absolutely right that we sometimes do the wrong thing by sealing it up in plastic or keeping it folded and pushed in the back part of a closet, because fabric does need to be unfolded and refolded so that you don't have
Well, the folds can really stay there for the next 100 years
yeah,
once
right.
they've been folded long enough.
Right, yeah. You won't hurt the quilt by putting it on the bed and using it.
We have a brief time. We'll take one more call from Joan in Charles City. Welcome to the program, Joan. Hello?
Hello.
Hi. We have a few seconds left in the program. Do you have a brief
yes.
story? Hi.
The caller a couple of calls ago was talking about wanting to donate her quilt to a place where it would be preserved. And I wondered if you're aware that the University of Nebraska has an extensive collection that they are preserving quilts in an environment that is very conducive to their good health.
Oh, good. Okay.
And I think the man's name was Carter, who gave them, I don't know,
okay,
maybe $2 or $3 million, and they are in temperature. They're stored in, I think it looks like they're in drawers. I've never seen this collection because they never have very many of them out at one time. But I think that'd be somebody that she'd want to get in contact with, and certainly be somebody within the neighborhood, closer than South Carolina.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. We appreciate your calling in, Joan.
Okay.
Bye-bye now. We have so there are some places to go, including the Hubert Herber West Branch Museum.
Well, we like to one of the hallmarks of what we do is to try to put people in touch with others who can help them.
Right.
We don't have the answers to everything.
Right.
And as Maureen's been doing exhibits for 32 years, and every one of them is a master's degree, she immerses herself in the topic. But then it's on to the next subject. And so ultimately, we want to help people preserve their past.
A couple of things you can mention about this particular collection as far as the ones that people should be aware of. What's the most representative here?
I won't even pick out one.
Okay.
I do have one favorite myself.
Okay.
However, from somebody who is not a quilter and just, you know, assuming that it's very nice patterns, beautiful colors, but you start, you know, step closer and start looking at all the quilting on the background fabric is absolutely exquisite. You think of the time and the effort and the joy and the pride that women took in creating these quilts. It's fascinating.
Well, and some of the wonderful superstitions that are associated with quilts, one that I love is sleep under a new quilt and your dreams will come true.
Aww. That's wonderful. Once again, Patterns of the Past, A Century of American Quilting, opens January 23rd. It goes through March 21st at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. I've been talking with Tim Walsh, the director, and the curator of the exhibit is Maureen Harding. That's on display now, or will be this Saturday
right.
It opens.
Yep.
You're tuned to Talk of Iowa. We're going to take a break for 5 minutes and be back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. A new survey by the Conference Board has some surprising news. Despite high unemployment, those who are employed are increasingly dissatisfied with the jobs they hold. Employee dissatisfaction is at its highest rate since 1987, the first year the survey was done. To find out why, I'll talk to Sarah Rines, University of Iowa Professor of Management.
Most people think about job satisfaction, who have studied it for a long time, as a gap between what people want from their work and what they think they're getting from their work. And anytime you have a situation where for many people work has in some way been getting worse, or even at a minimum not getting any better for a couple of years because people have come to expect improvements in work, promotions, raises, you know, a better future. So you have a couple of years of economic stagnation. The university, you had pay freezes. A lot of companies have had pay freezes, people losing their jobs, reduced promotion rates, baby boomers staying in on the job instead of retiring, frustrated young workers who aren't being promoted because promotion channels are being blocked, fewer promotions to save on costs. So the worker sees the job through the lens of what used to be and what their expectations were for the future. And on almost all of the major dimensions of what are important to people and jobs, there's either been stagnation or even a falling back, plus continued job insecurity for a large proportion of the workforce.
And this sounds really bleak. 61%, the figure in 1987, these are statistics from the Conference Board. That's job satisfaction in 1987 dropping to 45% today. Do you see any hope until the economy recovers, if it recovers?
I think there are some longer-term factors that are also making people nervous, that if the economy were to rebound, people would probably forget about them. But on top of this, we have a number of other environmental things that are going to make it difficult, at least in the United States, for these figures to rebound. I'm talking about things like people are very worried that perhaps the U.S. economy is not competitive anymore. They're looking at projections that Asia in particular and South America are going to be taking more and more jobs, particularly in manufacturing. They're looking at the fact that even jobs like lawyering and accounting and tax accounting have been outsourced to people who get trained in the American system and provide their services for a lot lower wages. So I think there's a lot of long-term uncertainty that's on top of what's going on at their immediate jobs. And then the other thing I want to mention is that probably the best leverage that an employer has in dealing with worker satisfaction or dissatisfaction has to do with whether or not the employer, especially through all their supervisors, somehow indicate to people that they care about them. They understand that things are stressed. They understand that it's difficult when people aren't getting raises. They understand it's difficult when nobody knows whether their jobs are secure. But a lot of times when this goes on for a long time, supervisors get sort of burned out from dealing with the layoffs, dealing with the pay freezes. Sometimes they don't have a good example at top management who isn't communicating enough with the workers about what's happening. And so you can get a lot of emotional burnout and people withdrawing from the workplace, and this is at a time when people need a lot of communication, a lot of support. So that's probably the thing that employers control the most is information and sympathy and showing that they care, but sometimes that doesn't happen either.
So you're saying managers are getting burned out just from having to talk to employees more and more.
Oh, yeah.
To reassure them. Yeah.
Especially when layoff is part of that.
Yeah, so workers need to hear more from their, even more from their managers, that things are okay, or at least give them the honest information about what may or may not be happening in the months ahead.
Right, and that they do care, that they're not just ignoring it, they're not indifferent to it, they're not numbed by it. Just that they care, that they understand the uncertainty. But you know, that's tough. Tough work, and not everybody's cut out for it. Not everybody has good role modeling at the top of the organization either to do that.
Getting back to job satisfaction, I suppose you could say that, I mean, for people who are employed, don't they consider themselves really lucky just to have a job? At least a lot of people may feel that way. So wouldn't that, in a sense, add to job satisfaction for those who have a job, that at least they have a job?
Well, I think that is a big factor for many people. I hear many people say that. At least I have a job, and they're genuinely grateful for that. And what do we have? We still have 45% of people in the workforce saying that they are satisfied. They're also touched by some of these other factors like declining income or frozen income or lack of promotions they expected. And the uncertainty of whether they might lose their jobs if they're in a workforce where people have been losing their jobs. Another thing that will happen is, and you know, you have the example at the university where some people agreed to accept furloughs. So even if you still have a job, there are an awful lot of other things that you can look at that might not compare so favorably to a year or two ago, which is sort of the way that people evaluate their satisfaction.
Well, if people are unsatisfied, are they angry at their employers? Are they angry at just the general situation in the economy? I mean, who are workers blaming for this lack of satisfaction?
I think you'd have to say that varies by the worker. Some are blaming their employer. Some are dissatisfied with the general environment. There's quite a few differences across employers, and then even within the same employer, some people have a predisposition to blame their employer more than other employees do.
Right.
So there's variance in that. You can't make an overall statement, I don't think.
In the state's government reorganization that's being debated, there's a lot of talk about middle managers being eliminated. It seems like for the last few years, you keep hearing more and more about, you know, let's get rid of middle managers. If you're a middle manager, what are you thinking?
Well, you're not thinking anything too happy when you hear, let's get rid of me.
Well, middle managers have important things to do, right? I mean,
well, and, you know, in many middle management positions, the span of control is already quite a bit larger than it was. And middle managers have always found themselves in difficult situation of passing on bad news that is the decisions are made at the top of the organization. The middle manager is the person that's got to carry it out, got to implement the decision. They might not have made the decision. So middle management has been stressful for a long time. I would say it's been a pressure point since at least the 80s when companies started downsizing their professional and administrative staff to compete with what they perceived to be the Japanese challenge. And so this has been an ongoing difficulty. I was just hearing some of the people who work for the university talk about how difficult this would actually be at the university, though, given how fluent some of our or fluctuating some of our positions are with the research environment, grants that come and go and so forth, and a lot of grant money where there's only one or two people working on a project underneath someone. There were some real questions raised about whether that's going to be workable at all at the university.
Well, okay, so more workers are dissatisfied. What does this mean for businesses and nonprofit organizations and government organizations? If you have workers who are not happy, what are the results? Higher absenteeism? Are they not as efficient? Or, I mean, what's happening?
Studies seem to show that you do have more turnover when people are unhappy. However, in an economy like this one, the people you're most likely to lose if they're unhappy are the ones who are the most marketable. So the people you're most likely to lose if they become unhappy are the ones who have the best skills and the best marketability. So that's bad. There are also some studies that show some very clever experimental studies out in the real world that where, for example, a pay freeze has been implemented, and in one unit the manager expresses sorrow for the pay freeze and says, I too am taking a pay freeze, and they explain why they had to take the pay freeze. You still get increases in things like theft and sabotage and absenteeism. But in a company where that doesn't happen, where there's no explanation, where no one says they're sorry, the rates soar even more. So you get sabotage, you get calling in sick, taking as much vacation as you possibly can, leaving if you can, but if you can't, sometimes not working as hard. And then in these very stressful situations, you do have increased medical bills because people develop medical problems. They might drink, they might eat too much, they don't get exercise, they're depressed, and so none of that adds up to high productivity in the long run.
And they're not taking their vacation. Many people are almost afraid to take vacation because they think, hey, if we take my 3 or 4 weeks off, I may come back and the job disappears or somebody's going to determine that I really am not that important to the organization. Are you seeing that at all?
Well, you're certainly hearing that. And, you know, if people are making relative judgments about who they're going to keep, you can't say that that's an irrational fear. The other reason people don't take all their vacation is that they have so much work stacked up when they come back that they're kind of, it's not very much of a release, or they worry too much about what's not happening when they're not there. So,
now you teach management at the University of Iowa.
Right.
What do you teach students about how to be a good manager, especially in this new environment?
Certainly, for lack of a better word, that it's very, very important to remain open to employees and to be compassionate to people and to share information about what is going on. And to the extent that you can, give people some control or some choices over their environment. So you can alleviate certain work pressures if it's possible for somebody to telecommute part of the time or to take a different kind of work schedule. Asking people's opinions and then making sure you follow through on it. But I'm hearing from people who deal with managers who are laying off a lot of people that they're also advising these managers to find some way to sometimes get away from it all, and they need to decompress. There's a term in the field that people in human resource management and some of these managers who end up delivering layoff news all the time, they call them toxin handlers. They're just constantly dealing with the negative emotions of stress. Mm-hmm. And dealing with poor management or dealing with conflict in the workplace, and they can be at serious risk of health problems of their own and depression.
I suppose if everything was perfect and there was perfect, you know, jobs were always 100% reliable, does this, in a way, as we turn the tables here, sort of, can that create almost too much complacency in workers in the sense that a little bit of unpredictability might be a good thing to a certain extent?
I think there are a lot of people who believe that many workers do or have taken things for granted and that it's not a bad thing for people to be aware of just how competitive the world workplace is. I think there's most people agree that we have to continue to get more efficient. I think the trick is in doing that in a way where people feel they're being brought along with that and they're contributing to that instead of just being constantly having things handed down to them that are negative and they don't feel they have any control over them. It's not easy. I'm sympathetic to managers, too. Very, very sympathetic. I think the classic movie for today is the Up in the Air movie.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it really speaks to what is going on. And there you've got a situation. You've got the guy at one point in the film saying, well, you know, they hire me because the managers don't have the guts to do it themselves. And there's another reason they do it is that it's a legally charged environment, and laying off people has all kinds of potential legal pitfalls. And so sometimes companies do things that seem extremely uncaring, like coming in with the armed guard and you're gone in an hour and they empty your computer disk and everything. It's very humiliating to the worker, and yet you sort of understand why it happens that way.
Yeah.
But talk about dissatisfaction and talk about the people who are left behind and how they feel about that. That's tough.
If you had a son or daughter who was just about to wrap up college and is now looking at some really strong negative thoughts about their future in the world of work. I mean, if they can even find a job, what would be your advice?
Sore spot here because I have a son in college. Right now, he's thinking he wants to be a lawyer someday. He's taking a major that isn't terribly practical, philosophy. And just this week, the number one emailed New York Times article on Sunday was about how many layoffs there have been in law, how insecure law jobs are, how even if you graduate from a top 10 law school, you may not get hired now, and how many of those people have been fired. So you've hit me close to home here. Honestly, I what would I tell my son? I keep telling my son, he'll tell you this, to work hard, make sure he doesn't do anything that ruins his opportunities for the future, but we don't, neither my husband nor I, are pressing him to get a more applied major. We're not telling him to be worried sick. We're trying to keep him confident and feeling as if he keeps working and keeps looking for opportunities and hangs in there, he will eventually find his place.
That's absolutely amazing. That, you know, it used to be that if you were majoring in law, you were pretty much guaranteed a job, but
it has been that way until quite recently. Even at the University of Iowa, I went to a session with, I believe it was the admissions officer, and he said they've had nearly 100% placement, even up until now. But it clearly, the last year, I think they said something like 14,000 law jobs were eliminated, and more are being eliminated. And on top of that, you have these people who joined the law firms and seeking to be partners. They're often working something like 70, 80, 90 hours a week. And this article was talking about how even with that, some of them can't buy a home if they live in a big city. So I read some articles about people who had astonishing resumes as seniors this year and just couldn't get their foot in the door. They were living back at home.
A story on NPR just the other day about English majors who, for those in graduate college, it's taking 9 years plus to get that PhD, and then there's no guarantee, obviously, of a job. I don't know, is there anything that's certain out there today? Other than maybe nursing?
Well, there are a couple of fields that people are talking about. Healthcare is one. All kinds of things in healthcare. And there's some optimism about education, although I'm not exactly sure what about education. But they certainly predict that as a growth area. But I'm not thinking of, and certainly some areas of technology still.
Well, what about MBAs? You're in the College of Business Administration. Does an MBA guarantee you a job?
It doesn't guarantee you a job, but and honestly, I'm probably not the best person to ask right now because it fluctuates from year to year. We changed things in our MBA program quite a bit this past year to give students much more project work, much more real consulting work while they're in the school. And also to give them basically majors, they call them academies, that are a bit more specialized. So what we were finding was that employers really wanted to hire an MBA who either really knew finance, really knew marketing, or really knew operations and innovation and computer science. So we changed things so that people specialize more in one of those three areas, and they get a lot of consulting and project and internship work while they're here. And I think that is the way to place MBAs. But it will always be cyclical from year to year. There are some years that Harvard has trouble.
It's so difficult to be optimistic now with this job market. And is there any signs of any kind which would give us some hope, especially for young people to find jobs and jobs that are reliable and pay well and have decent benefits.
A lot of people are thinking much more now of taking advantage of these public service jobs like Teach for America, Peace Corps. I've certainly seen an increase in people who are considering that for a year or two, nonprofit work for a year or two. Basically, we're telling people to get their foot in the door with good experience, even if that first job doesn't have benefits or that first job doesn't pay what they want, because that seems to be the only way to do it. That and what's always been true is building a network of people, not just close people, but a lot of jobs are found through sort of casual networking as well. But I think you do have to tell people to try to stay optimistic in all of this, because it's very difficult to pursue job search when you're depressed.
Professor Sarah Rhines, University of Iowa, thank you. This has been very interesting, and I hope you have a great spring semester.
Thank you very much, and good luck to everybody out there who either does or doesn't have a job right now.
Thanks a lot. Sarah Rhines is the University of Iowa Professor of Management. She added that one sign of hope will be an increasing number of jobs in the area of sustainability, or the so-called green jobs, and for graduates who are willing to work abroad in the area of economic development. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shamp.